Blog Talk Radio.
Rise Up by Eddie Vedder off Into the Wild soundtrack. This is Your Mother's Medicine Cabinet, brought to you by the 8,000 people, or this week will be 8,000, I kind of forget every week, of the Literary Underground. This week we've got James Duncan of the Hobo Camp Review, Spurs fan extraordinaire, and the have you ever seen the movie Twins with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito? That would be James and Tim Duncan of the Spurs. But I think this is him online, so we are taking callers, so if you want to call later, that's cool. But James?
Hey, Frank, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Did
that's
I just call
cool,
you
man.
Guys
that's
like
fun.
Did I just say Tim and John Duncan? Well, I don't know. But
yeah,
so how's it going?
That's pretty accurate, though.
Yeah.
Things are good, man. I'm just sitting here in my windowless bunker in Queens, surrounded by my P&B posters of Tim Duncan. And it's a good night, man. Good night for an interview. What's going on with you?
Just sitting here in the middle of nowhere in my bunker as well, because I actually have an underground apartment. So, but
right,
for some reason, I believed that I thought that you lived in Albany. Is that where your like family lives?
Yeah, that's where I was kind of born and raised. I like to call it where fun goes to die. it's a small city. It's what you make of it. And if it wasn't the capital, it wouldn't be on the map. But, grew up around there. Yeah.
So what brings you to Queens? You working out there or something?
Yeah, traveled around a little bit, finally latched on to a good job that doesn't make me want to slip my wrists. And, things are good. Finally got into the magazine biz. I'm actually getting paid for my writing, which is a change. Living in the big city, working for a magazine, it's not bad right now. Not bad. Been in much
That's
worse
good.
Spot.
Are you sipping on the scotch or whiskey tonight?
You know, I'm working my way through a flask of Jameson, and I'm almost done, so I think I'm ready.
Yeah. So I'm going to hand it over to you and say, why don't you tell the listeners about the Hobo Camp review and how it all came about and what you're doing with it.
Sure. Started in 2009. It was right around the time when, like, MySpace was starting to die out. And, you know, MySpace was great because you know, you found somebody that you liked and their work was right there. The blogs were right there. You could kind of hopscotch to other people that you like. You know, you'd discover other people pretty easily. I thought that was a good thing about that place. But I was going through a phase where I just wasn't seeing anybody new that was really grabbing my attention. And I was going to readings in town. I was living in Texas at the time. And wasn't happy with anything I was hearing at the readings. It was either, you know, puppy dogs and flowers, or it was, you know, screaming into a microphone about something or other. You know, my daddy didn't hug me enough when I was a kid or something. And it just, you know, nothing was grabbing me. So I thought, you know, I always wanted to do some sort of press. If you do it online, it's cheap, and I didn't have any money. So I'm going to post what I like. This is kind of the realm of poetry that really that does it for me. And, you know, the kind of transient type poetry and you know, something that's a little dark but not, you know, not evil, not angry, not too aggressive. It's you know, something with a little misfortune but a little mischief too. And I wasn't seeing much of that, so I kind of posted it, and I thought, you know, if I get some, I get some. If I don't, I don't. And lucky enough, I discovered a ton of great people that, at least to me, you know, for only selfish reasons, I wanted these people to come to me and me discover them. Yeah, I felt good about that, being able to share it with other people. Because I felt like at the time I was putting in a lot of time and effort into trying to find new people, and it wasn't working out. So I tried to switch the flow and have them come to me instead. And it's been working out. Been loving it.
So do you see anything in the future? You're just going to keep it in the same format? Because you're thinking about doing a few books a year perhaps, right?
Yeah, you know, it's a quiet little spot of the internet right now, and I'd like to keep it that way. I'm not trying to take over the world with this thing. It's just a, you know, place where you can go, kind of the internet's version of underneath the train trestle, and just kind of sit there by the fire and hear a few stories. And I don't really want to move away from that too much with the actual review, but I would like to kind of branch out and maybe take it another step with maybe doing a book a year with somebody, maybe a contributor or somebody that I find that really speaks to me, and I'd like to share something more than just a poem or two online. So, yeah, I'm going to kick off a press, I think, and, you know, take it a book at a time, see how it goes.
And you said you wanted to read a few of someone else's poems before you got into yours tonight.
I thought that might be fun, you know, read some, because like I said, I stumbled across some people that, some I already knew of, and I'd already liked their work, and I was hoping they would come to me, and they did, and I also discovered some people that I hadn't read before, ever, and one of them that became a real favorite of mine, I have a few of his chapbooks, is Jeffrey Alfier, and
okay.
He, a lot of working class poetry. And I've always liked it, so I'm going to kick it off with one of his, from a chapbook of his called Bluesman's Daughter, and this one's called Waking Late for the Night Shift. And I read this to myself a couple times earlier in the night and fucked it up every time, so let's give it a go here. Waking Late for the Night Shift. Wind buffets her filmy bedroom window, from which a bowed figure is seen moving down the street, going door to unanswered door. A street named for flowers not found within miles of the city. Looking skyward, she can't question metallic ash soiling icy clouds above the refinery where she works, nor freight cars at the edge of vision, laboring slowly as if to give rail cops and switchmen a slip. As her lover stirs, he can only offer her a weak, drowsy kiss, so she moves downstairs to the kitchen, her new form shivering from a draft, as she inhales coffee steaming out of a cracked porcelain cup. Leaving in work dungarees, a streetlight throws her jagged shadow across the dark entryway. Then down the front steps, worn to anonymity, snow falling softly as the door behind her. That's it.
Cool. And
yeah,
he's out in California, is he not?
He is, yeah. He's the editor of San Pedro River Review, and he's out there in California, and he runs that with Toby Cogswell. They do a pretty damn fine job, if you ask me. A lot of that type of poetry you'll find in their review, too. If you haven't heard from him, definitely look him up. Really, really good.
No. Yeah, I believe April was in that review before. I've seen it over here before. It's good stuff. But so you obviously put up the Hobo Camp review because you were looking for other people because you were not so inspired. So you as a writer yourself of poetry and prose, what, alive or dead, who are people that inspired you to, you know, want to pick up the pen and hit the keys at first?
Sure. Well, you know, I haven't really been writing poetry for too long. I started in 2005, and before then, it didn't grab me. It didn't interest me at all. And I think even if I tried it, it would have been really shitty because I just, you know, late teens, early 20s, you haven't really lived. No one's really lived. And least of all me. But I went through a pretty shitty, I was married for a couple of years. I went through a really shitty divorce. It was terrible. And I found myself kind of hopping around with nowhere to live, unemployed, living off whatever money I had saved up. And so I was going through a really rough time and just kind of wandering in Albany and went to a bookstore and saw a name on a bookshelf. And a guy in college, this guy was, he worked on tugboats, and, you know, big Irish drinker. And he said, "You've got to read this guy sometime." And I did read him in college. And I read one or two poems. And I said, "This guy's shit. He's terrible." And it's going to sound cliche, but the name on the bookshelf was Charles Bukowski. And I pulled him off. And I went in the back, and I just started flipping through and reading it. And it was like a goddamn revelation. It was, you know, what he was writing on the page was kind of how I felt. You know, just kind of lost. I got nothing going for me. You know, I just had the shit kicked out of me. And it made me feel like I could do something, even if it's not really going to get me too much further down the road. You know, it was something to do to kill the time and kind of get the demons and the hate and the pain out of me and, you know, onto the page. And it started from there, you know, from there. It sounds cliche, but I went to Kerouac because I loved On the Road, but I hadn't read his poetry. And it was just dominoes from there. You know, Lee Poe, Neruda, Lorca, Platt. But one of my absolute favorites was Carl Sandburg, you know, kind of a throwback. He's about as far back as I can get and still kind of find it accessible and enjoyable. You know, he kind of melds that kind of working class poetry with a little bit of magic, a little bit of midnight magic, man. So it was cool. It was good. Sandburg.
Yeah, it's it's might not be like cliche to say those names without getting into conversation about people that are already dead, but you know, they're good gateways for a lot of people. Usually, when you discover those two, they turn you on to so many other different people. You find yourself into people that are alive that you discover. You know, that's what I saw. So why don't you Your new book just came out, correct? Why don't you tell everybody what it's called and how they can get it?
Sure, yeah. It's actually kind of associated with the press that I want to move into with the Hobo Camp. You know, I wanted to try my hand at it, go through all the steps myself, and I didn't want to invite somebody else to come in and take their words and their work, again, because it's really important to them, and then somehow fuck it up down the line somehow, you know, my fault. Yeah, I wanted to go through all of the steps of putting it together and making the cover and finding distributors and getting reviewers and dealing with the printer and everything myself before I did somebody else's work, because I know how important it is to them. So I decided to try with mine, because if I screw up with mine, then it's just mine. And so Dealing with the Devil in the Middle of the Road will be the first book out from Hobo Camp Press. And it's actually out right now. It's available right now. And it's kind of an anthology. It kind of encapsulates all of the writing I've done since 2005. It pulls from a lot of published works and magazines that I've had since then, and some of the best pieces from the chat books I've done since then as well, and a couple dozen new ones in there. And I just wanted something to kind of show where I've been, where I am, maybe, if I'm lucky, where I'm going. And because I haven't been writing as much poetry now as I used to, focusing more and more on fiction. So I know I'll still write poetry, but in a sense, for me, this kind of feels like kind of a tip of the hat to my most productive period for poetry. So, yeah, I guess I can read one from that, if you want to do that.
Yeah, go for it.
Cool. All right. Let's see. All right, how about this one? This one is called Dollar for Your Thoughts. At some point, strippers must stop writing poetry, or at least admitting to it, because three in one night is too much of a coincidence to not suspect a ruse, or suspect that every one of us secretly has an art beyond pole dancing, crunching numbers, driving race cars, landing planes, loading trucks, amputating arms, or pouring drinks for yuppies on a Friday night in a club in New York City. And maybe this is the perfect place to let that secret go flowing out into the world. Total anonymity. Fake names, fake bodies, fake explanations for being out to three and smelling like baby powder and desperation. A smell that never smelled so good until you realize how lonely it makes you feel. So, you let go of your secrets. You admit to writing poetry, or painting with oils, or learning how to speak Russian so you can read Dostoevsky in his native tongue. You admit to all the things you hide from your friends, siblings, coworkers, lovers, everyone you know, living vicariously through the truths you tell strangers as skin touches skin, and eyes look away, return, and then close, shutting the door to the soul once again.
Nice, man. Real nice. They got, I'm going to get this question out of the way because it's the question, one question I ask everybody. What is the, what is your view on the internet? Do you think it dilutes the talent pool, or do you think it's like a good thing, or maybe both, because, you know, a lot of us wouldn't be able to know happenings or publishing houses or something of that nature, whereas like 50 years ago they might have had to stay in three or four different cities. Do you think it's any good, or do you think it dilates the talent pool too much?
Well, you know, I think whether or not it's good or bad is always going to be debatable, but I think the main point is this is who we are now. You know, the internet is the tool for everything now. It's just ingrained in every single thing that we do. And so I think in that sense, it enhances our ability to network, to discover people that, you know, if I lived in New York and I never traveled, I never would hear of all these great things going on in, you know, California or, you know, or Kansas City or Austin, Texas or something like that. And I wouldn't meet poets from those places unless I actually got up off my ass and went there. And I've discovered so many amazing writers from MySpace or Facebook or these online zines and stuff like that. So, you know, For all the crap poetry that's out there, there's going to be, you know, the good poets are going to be there, too. You just have to sift through it. And, you know, if you're bad, it's going to be bad. People are going to see it. And but if you're good, you know, you're going to stand out. And, you know, I think as a tool, it's incredibly effective. And I don't have a beef with it at all.
Nice. I understand what you're saying because we are the generation, or anybody who's over 25 and under 45 is the generation in transition, is the way I like to think of it. You know, we grew up with Atari, but or whatever, Sega, but now we're going into, because the kids who are just born now are going to have some crazy kind of shit that's going to make what we have look stupid, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And, you know, it's great because it gives us the ability to organize kind of throwback readings or tours like it used to be like, you know, like you guys were going out to California and to Oakland and you know, seeing events like that pop up all over the place and seeing the same, you know, groups or, you know, different people all the time, but sometimes a core of people going from city to city to city, you know, all of that enabled through meeting on the internet and being able to plan things. And, you know, I saw back in, 2008, in December, November, I saw, I guess, you know, they were going by the Beards. That was, you know, the you know, Provost and Dorsey and all them. You know, I've been following them on MySpace and saw that, you know, they were all going from city to city, and they came to New York City, and I was extremely fortunate to be able to see them at the Bowery Poetry Club. And again, without you know, MySpace, I never would have heard these poets and never would have got to see them read. So it's as corny as MySpace and Facebook can be, as much of a pain in the ass they can be from time to time, they can be a godsend too. So.
Right on. So why don't you go into, if you have, give us one more of the people from the Hobo Camp Review, and then we're going to probably just dedicate it to the rest of your work.
Yeah, sure. All right. This one's a new one. It's in the new issue. And this guy has submitted a few times. And everyone out there, if an editor at a magazine tells you, feel free to submit again. I'd love to see more of your work. It's not just blowing smoke up your ass. I could tell this guy had some stuff that I might like, but he wasn't hitting me with the right poem. And finally, when this one came in this last June, for me at least, I thought he hit it out of the park. He's from some little island out beyond Madagascar, and I'm going to fuck up his name royally, but I'm going to give it a shot. It's Amit Parmasur. I hope that's right. It's what I'm going with. And the poem is called "He Believes He's American." I hate this white, red, and blue flag floating high in the sky of my mind. I've never been to any school to learn about its possible ramifications. I live in the jungle where I can't rule despite being a muscular lion. Every night I grope for meaning below a million brilliant sweet stars. I think of the white as a pure butterfly and as the shroud of my erratic life. This white is also my wife, on whom I want to cheat every midnight. I think of the red as bloody charlatans, and as the flower of a passion I've had to sell. This red is also the future, which has robbed my sinews of present and past. I think of the blue as a powerful bullet, and the missing part of my dream suicide. This blue is also my unborn child, because of whom I'm called a eunuch. And when all the colors in the world tango and tangle in my blind, brittle heart, I have more of the blues every black night. I feel I am burning religiously in hell, and I have to hate all the heavenly apes trying hard to outwit my ignorance.
Nice, man. That was pretty cool. I probably wouldn't have been able to pronounce his name either. He's out in Madagascar area.
Yeah, some island nation beyond that, and I just can't remember the name right now. But, I thought it was a cool poem about maybe what it means to be American by someone who's not American at all, and thought it was a good take.
Cool. Just want to let the listeners know that sometimes they like to call in, so if you'd like to call in and ask James a question, you can do so. Until then, we're just going to talk for the next 23 minutes. So, you didn't tell the people how to get your new book, or any, perhaps if you're any of your old chapbooks are still around and out there, how can they get them? Do they have to order them through the Hobo Camp Review site or Amazon?
They can go to the Hobo Camp Review site. They can go to my website. If you just Google James H. Duncan, it'll come up, but it's also available on Amazon. So if you search on Amazon for James Duncan, Dealing with the Devil, I'm sure it'll pop up. And it's 180 pages, $9. If you order through me, you can email me. I'll sign it for you, send it out the door. I've got a bunch going out Friday or Saturday. I should have my shipment from the printer coming midweek. So, I'm out there. If you give it a Google, you'll find it.
Yeah, I got one of your chap books, and I really liked it, so I would like to have the devil on my bookcase probably next week when I can afford to do so. So let the world know when there's more copies from the printer. But,
absolutely, man. Yeah, I definitely still have plenty left over. I bought probably way too fucking much, but the chat that you have, some of those poems are in here too. The Maybe a Bird Will Sing, that was the one. And I'm incredibly thankful for all the work and time and effort that he put into that one, Lester Allen. he was a huge supporter of my work back in the day, back in 2009. And I actually, we haven't spoken much recently, but I'm just, you know, so grateful for him taking the time to kind of put together a collection of my work. It's one of the first times somebody else stepped in and said, just give me a bunch and let's work on it, and I'm going to take it from there. So this new book, Dealing with the Devil in the Middle of the Road, is dedicated to Lester Allen. So, he's out there.
Yeah, old Lester fell off the face of the earth.
No, man.
I think I talked to him like on Facebook like 6 months ago, and he's like, "Oh man, you know I'm working. I'll get back in contact with you soon," and just never heard from him again. I hung around with him once in Connecticut. He was a pretty awesome guy. Hope he comes back around soon, Lester, if you're out there. So, anyways, you're pretty into prose writing. I see a lot of you saying how. You're finishing novels or working on novels. For you, what's the difference? You know, you work for a magazine, so you're obviously doing some kind of journalism. So what's the difference between the three for you? Is it hard to balance them all in a way, different three styles?
For me, it's not hard to balance them. I think if I didn't have that other outlet to go to, I'd lose my damn mind. It's a completely different way of thinking. You know, poetry is very, you know, I draw upon my own experiences, but when I sit down in front of the typer, it feels very instantaneous, and it just kind of it comes out, and it's more emotional. It's like a, you know, it's a shot in the dark. Bam, it's there, and then you know, you can kind of look at it later and tweak it a little bit if you want. But the fiction, I started out in college doing journalism and doing fiction, and I was writing stories when I was a kid, 8 or 9. I'm like stupid stories about like the squirrels that live in trees behind my house and having to do crap. I always knew I wanted to be a writer somehow. I wanted to write books. I wanted to write short stories. And so being able to switch back and forth between, you know, late at night, knock out 2 or 3 poems, feel good about that, the next day, sit down and, you know, working on a chapter that you've been working on all week and tinkering. And you think in the long term when you're working on a novel, and I'm working on my 4th one right now, and it's just a completely different wavelength in the mind that it's nice to kind of go to that when you've been working on poetry too much, and then to get away from that, to have poetry to go to. And journalism has always been cool for me. I've always really liked it. Hunter Thompson was a big fan of his. I was a teenager in college. I know some people are turned off by the political angle, but back until about 2006, all through high school until about, you know, until I was about 26 years old, I was huge in politics. So journalism, politics went hand in hand for me, heavily involved in all that, but definitely not anymore. Pulled myself out of that game for good.
Cool, man. So why don't you give us another one of your poems from your any of your books that you want to read?
All right. Let's see. Alright, this one's bounced around a couple times. Some people might know, but I say that, probably nobody's fucking heard it before. It's one of my favorites. It's about a bar that no longer exists, one of my favorite bars in San Antonio, and they tore it down and put up some sort of corporate Irish bar thing that's really clean and smells like Lysol and overlit piece of shit. But there used to be this great dive bar called Blanco Tavern, so this poem is called Our Foreman at Blanco Tavern. You know when you drink and start promising shit, like getting engaged or driving friends to El Paso? There's a reason why Lone Star is only $1 a bottle and that Dos Equis is on special in almost every bar. It keeps things moving, keeps the gears greased and bored from getting lazy trigger fingers. At least that's the general idea. But when a rookie bartender spends all of his time in the corner chatting at the young couple that everybody knows doesn't belong, ignoring all those empties around the counter, well, it doesn't help things much. You can almost hear the grinding halt of the world as the regular with the glass eye stabs the bar top with his 8-inch boot blade. It demands a round for everyone but the nice couple in the corner. That guy with the glass eye? He's kind of like that foreman everybody trusts to keep things moving, but saves the hell off your back so long as you don't stand around throwing wrenches into the works.
Nice. That was a really good one.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Like that poem, Miss That Place. It was a real dank little dive, man, but it was a good time.
So, there's like something similar that in our lives we both went through crappy divorces and traveled all over the place, kind of trying to find our niche. Now that you're like all settled out there in Queens and sort of getting there, living your dream, working, writing for magazines, do you ever miss those days traveling, hoboing around?
You know, I kind of do. Part of it feels like I'm getting to be a real fucking bore. Because I just, you know, you go to work and I come home and I just kind of huddle here in my little bunker and, you know, work on a book or a short story or a poem. And I don't go to the bar every now and then, but I do miss, yeah, I definitely miss the days of going out, staying all night, every single night, freelancing. I went through a lot of stretches where I was unemployed for long periods of time and just kind of living off whatever I could get through the word. And, which was kind of great because I was really poor, but the bars that open early, they're the ones that always have, like, $1.50 drafts until 4 p.m., you know? So you get there at 9 in the morning, and for, you know, $10, that's your day, and it's a great day. And, you know, sometimes I'll be sitting in my office looking at a spreadsheet or in a meeting, going, God damn, I wish I was broke. I wish I was, you know, couch surfing or something, you know? I could really go for a beer right now. But, you know, I don't know. I guess some people can do it forever, but, yeah, you can't do that forever. You got to...
No, man, you can't. I agree. Eventually, the madness of it gets to you, and you got to calm down somewhere, or you're just going to put your face through a window or jump off a building or something crazy. Now, don't anybody go jumping off a building out there if you're homeless. It will turn around. So, all right, give us another poem from your book.
All right, cool, yeah. Actually, yeah, another San Antonio poem. This one is called A Debt Paid, speaking of homeless people. There is a bum who lives in the garage behind my neighbor's house. The garage faces an alleyway, one long alleyway of garages and trash cans, very quiet, very private. Most garage doors are open a crack to keep the air moving, to keep the heat from spoiling their paint, gas, etc. I saw him back there one night. His cigar light caught my eye as I walked home drunk up the alley from Winston's pub. He stubbed it out and slipped further back into the garage, the door open all the way, the moon bringing his eyes in sight. I saw him there, saw the fear and the darkness surrounding those gleaming eyes. He wasn't hurting anyone, just sleeping there. And I've seen him since many times, always at night, or always just traced hints that he was there, cigar ash and the like. The old lady, she might mind if she knew, but she doesn't know, and I won't be the one. In fact, last night I left a cigar and a pack of matches there for him before it got too dark out, before he arrived. And I knew he found it because I saw ash the next day, the one burnt matchstick, and a rock scratched thanks on the pavement. It's a nice little garage in a clean, quiet alleyway, and I know I'd sleep there if I found myself in the same spot, and it would be nothing better than to find a cigar waiting for me every now and then. Something to fend off the coming of dawn, the death of the heart, the end of the line.
Nice, man. It's about them small things, dude, sometimes, like a cigar or whatever, that when you're out there hoboing and living, it's those small things like the cigar that keep you alive, that keep hope going inside of you.
Exactly.
That's what I tell you,
man. Yeah. It really is. You know, when you grow up kind of, you know, I definitely grew up in a lower class household. You know, when I was a little kid, I remember having food stamps and not having a lot, but my mom really, you know, she busted her ass and did her best, and she was amazing. But, you know, growing up in that kind of atmosphere, then being unemployed for long stretches when you're out of college, you know, those little things like a cigar or somebody buys you a drink or, you know, you got a day off. You know, some people, it's huge. It's just the tiny little comforts of life. That's all you need, man. All the bigger shit, it doesn't matter.
It teaches you a lot, too, man. Straightens out that ego a little bit, too. Humbles you,
right,
I guess.
You're humble, that's for sure.
Mm.
Man, it makes me want to light up a cigar that I got sitting over there.
Yeah, I got one around here somewhere. Yeah.
But
yeah, hey, you know, I got a question for you if you don't mind.
All right.
It's I know you brought him up a few times. It's not a poet that I read a lot of, and I'm kind of embarrassed to admit it. But you are a big fan of Jeffers, and I haven't read any Jeffers, and I mean to ask you on Facebook or something if you could suggest, like, if somebody wanted to get into him, is there a starting point? Is there something that's really
He's a hard to get into a starting point because, like, without getting too much into this history, but, like, he was really popular in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Then he spoke out against World War II, so he's basically shunned the last 20 years of his life.
Oh.
And he kind of fell off the face of the earth, but now with this whole, like, revival of, Save the Planet stuff, he's coming back. But, you know, his deal was human beings are incapable of seeing beauty, most of them, you know, so because they're so caught up with who they are. But, yeah, his I can send you a few links to a book. I had a book of his selected poetry that's like 100 pages that you can get as a starting point. For like, you can find it for like $6 on Amazon, and it's really good. But, you know, I would suggest, if you liked it, to get his, like, complete poems, which is like an 800-page volume that was put out. But he's starting to I discovered him through Bukowski because he uses his inhumanism, like, views, but towards a city as opposed to, like, you know, Monterey, like he did, like Jeffers did. But he writes in long lines. He doesn't have, like, short, skinny poems or anything like that. He's he's, like, putting, like things like hawks and the ocean into, like, Greek tragedies or something. It's pretty awesome. It's really out there. But, yeah, you should check him out. Like, he's a huge influence on me, especially nowadays, because I feel as I understand it more now than I did 5 years ago, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But,
definitely.
Hey, we got a caller for James Duncan
on
the last 8 minutes of the show. So let's see who wants to speak to you. You're on live with James Duncan.
Hi, Frank. Hi, James. This is Jeff calling from Boston. Enjoyed your reading. Nice job. Some nice work there. The question I had for you is that there's so many great poets out there that I've read through chapbooks, you know, Frank and Dan Provost and Dorsey. Great stuff. My question is that where do you see the future for poetry for, you know, as it stands today in the sense of bringing it more to the mainstream like it used to be? I think the internet is a way to do that. And would you agree with that in the sense, though, that I think it needs to find its own form, if you will, a new form, a more experimental type of form, because it seems like we're still in the heavy shadow of the Beat Generation.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I feel like we're definitely in the shadow of the greats of the past, and we've kind of been searching for an identity here for a little while. One of my biggest concerns with poetry now is it sometimes feels a little incestuous. It kind of feels like poets are writing for poets, and the only people reading poetry are other poets, and most of the people that I know who are not poets do not read poetry. They'll read a poem from time to time, but they don't have collections, they don't have chapbooks, they don't know about readings. And I think we need to make a very concerted effort as poets to draw in the people who wouldn't read poetry on their own without some help, without somebody saying, come with me to a reading, or here, I got you this chapbook, give it a read. And I think, of course, everybody's going to write how they're going to write. You've got to write, you know, to you. But I think some people nowadays, these people that I've spoken to, are turned off by poetry that is not accessible. I'm not saying poetry that isn't accessible is good. I'm just saying that if we want to bring more people into the fold, at least introducing them
two poets who, you know, aren't so abstract that you're going to read, you know, a verse and think, I don't know what the fuck's going on here, and just get completely turned off by the whole thing. I brought a friend who wasn't really a poet to a slam once, and I brought him the wrong thing. He was yelling, it was not his thing, it was a bad way to introduce him to poetry, but rambling a bit here, but I think the point is that I think we need to make more of an effort to really kind of embrace people who don't read poetry on a regular basis, and I think that will help guide us towards who we're going to be in the future, because I think otherwise we're just going to keep going in a circle, and I don't think that's healthy for poetry.
All right, that's a great point, and there was a French New Wave filmmaker by the name of Jean-Luc Godard who once said that you have to disguise art as entertainment for the masses. So somehow there has to be that bridge to bring the general populace over. You give them an entertainment, but you're disguising it in art. Now, how that translates to poetry, I don't know. I wish I knew.
Yeah, that's like,
however,
let me throw in the two cents at first that every generation is overshadowed by another generation, and say that we might be overshadowed now by the Beat Generation, but they were also overshadowed by, what was that, the Lost Generation, what were they called? I think something like that. Hoover, it keeps going back and back. I think that, you know, of course it has to be entertainment in a way, but I'm also myself not going to get up on stage and, like, get on a unicycle and honk a horn and read for people. Like, you know, just do what you do. And I think that people who always just did what they did, and they did it good, it spoke for itself. And, you know, I've got a stack of books sitting here right at my table next to my computer that, you know, have, there are plenty of different people in there that did what they did, and they did fine. And there's that big misconception that if you write, you know, prose, you're going to make a lot more money. Sure, if you can sell the book, you know,
right.
and then if people can buy the book, you know. So I think that with this generation of kids growing up, the attention span, like Nats, I'm not saying it can't be done, but it seems a hell of a lot harder. I mean, they're more concerned with their text messaging and their reality programming and whatever it is that's out there, I think, you know.
Yeah,
but,
I also feel that poetry itself, in my opinion, never will be fully accepted by the public like film or music will be. It's something more ephemeral. There's something more on the edge about it that, you know, taps into something deeper, and maybe this is a very pessimistic point of view about the public in general, but I think there's always going to be a large segment of people who just can't naturally tap into that, that don't have an interest in tapping into something beyond, you know, their humdrum everyday life. I just think that, you know, poetry will evolve, but I don't think poetry will always involve everybody, and I'm okay with that.
Well,
I was
going to say that the lady came on, I'm down to the last 60 seconds, so I kind of have to go. sorry to cut the conversation short. But it was good to have you on, James Duncan.
Thanks for having me, Frankie. Yeah, it was a good time.
Sorry to cut this conversation short. You can get James's stuff at his blog, his website, hobocampreview.com. You can ask me on my Facebook page how to get a hold of him. You can get a hold of him through my Facebook page. And until then, James... Guess I'll see you on the other side of the computer screen and next NBA season.
Damn right, yeah. All right, man. I'll talk to you later.
All right, later. Next week our guest is going to be John Yamaris. And after that, Dina Rash Guzman. So, I don't know, whatever.